And that was Tom Petty with Wake Up Time from his classic album, Wildflowers. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew Dzingel here with Heidi Holton. And we receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We've got some local news coming up with the Up North Report.
And we receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company powering the region's homes, businesses, and industries since 1923. Learn more about its vision of a carbon-free future at mnpower.com/energyforward. And like Heidi said, now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The judge overseeing the case against former State Senator Justin Eichhorn has granted a motion by federal prosecutors. The motion asked her to reconsider releasing him to a halfway house after his court hearing on Wednesday morning. The order issued late Monday by Judge Shannon G. Elkins pauses a previous order that set the conditions of his release. It also says she will reconsider whether to keep Eichhorn in jail before his trial. The case development comes after Eichhorn allegedly lied in court and sought to obstruct the investigation into his attempt to solicit a minor. The motion filed Sunday says since his arrest, Eichhorn has lied about having a gun in his St. Paul apartment and sought help from a, quote, close associate to remove a laptop from that residence. Eichhorn was arrested March 17th after authorities say he attempted to solicit an undercover officer he believed to be a 17-year-old offering prostitution services in an online ad. The Grand Rapids Republican resigned from the Senate 3 days later. The dates for the special election to fill the vacancy in Senate District 6 following Eichhorn's resignation are now set. A writ of special election signed by Governor Tim Walz says the election will be Tuesday, April 29th. A special primary election will be April 15th if necessary to narrow the field. The candidate filing period opens Wednesday and runs through April 1st. Thus far, at least 7 Republican candidates and 2 DFL candidates have announced their intentions to campaign for the open seat in Senate District 6, which covers parts of Cass, Crow Wing, and Itasca counties. This includes the cities of Grand Rapids, Brainerd, and Baxter. The 2 newest entrants into the race are Steve Cotario of Merrifield, running as a Republican, and Nikki Hardy of Pequot Lakes, running as a DFLer. Cotario is a small business owner and a veteran who unsuccessfully ran for the Crosby-Ironton School Board during the last election. Hardy is a substitute teacher in the Pequot Lakes and Pine River Backus schools and a former scientific researcher. Learn more about these candidates and all the others at KAXE.org. The KAXE News team will be putting together an election guide for this race, and we want your help. Find a form to submit questions you'd like us to ask the candidates on our Facebook page and at our website. Industry groups say Minnesota is short more than 100,000 affordable housing units to meet demand. Project leaders say the Trump administration's escalating trade war creates more uncertainty in addressing this critical need. Last week, the National Association of Home Builders warned that the Trump administration's aggressiveness on tariffs could increase the cost of building a home by more than $9,000. Cecil Smith of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association says it depends on the situation for each project, but acknowledges it's possible. He says it adds to the other market forces affordable housing developers are already dealing with.
We have a lot of uncertainty in the economy right now, and tariffs is one factor that's, making business very nervous.
Minnesota has invested money to accelerate affordable housing, but Smith says momentum is slow because of higher interest rates and regulatory issues. Lawmakers are trying to fix some of these problems this session. The White House insists its approach will pay off for the economy while acknowledging short-term challenges. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. A memorial to Native American military veterans could soon be erected on the grounds of the Minnesota Capitol under a bill that was advanced by a state Senate committee on Friday. Sam Cito of Report for Minnesota reports that the measure authored by New Brighton DFLer Senator Mary Kunish would create a task force for establishing the memorial. The 13-member task force would be appointed by the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs and include one veteran from each of Minnesota's 11 federally recognized tribes. Kunisch said she was inspired to author the bill by a trip to see the National Native American Veterans Memorial's 2020 unveiling in Washington, D.C. Native Americans serve in the United States military at a higher rate than any other ethnic group. Kunisch said recognizing Native Americans' contributions is particularly important following the removal of military content related to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives under an executive order issued by President Donald Trump. The Senate Committee on Agriculture, Veterans, Broadband, and Rural Development approved the bill unanimously, referring it to the State and Local Government Committee for further discussion. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
And that is the Up North Report, local news from our region. And you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heidi Holton. Coming up next, we're going to be hearing about Intel hearing on the texted war plans, FCC remote internet case, and March Napness.
That's a really
competition for bears.
It's a really fun story about how bears nap and this bracket competition of when the bears are going to wake up. So how would you do in a nap competition?
Not very well. I don't nap very long.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
But you do nap?
I do nap.
Do you get refreshed by the shortness?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. Yeah, I wish I was able. I used to be quite a napper, and I actually did nap yesterday. But sometimes they're too long, and that messes everything up.
Yep.
We received support this morning from Itasca Economic Development Corporation, creating and retaining quality jobs in Itasca County through education, research, and connections with businesses, working to help grow small businesses of all sizes and strengthen our local workforce. Learn more at itascadv.org.
And we received support from Deo's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com.
Today we're looking at partly cloudy skies, highs 46 to 50, mostly cloudy in the evening as well, 25 to 30, mostly sunny tomorrow, Thursday, highs 46 to 53 degrees, and overnight lows in the upper 20s to low 30s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a case at the Supreme Court today over how much power Congress can give over to federal agencies. But first,
the Trump administration is in damage control mode after the revelation this week that top national security officials shared secret war plans in a group chat that included a journalist. President Trump was asked about it yesterday.
We've pretty much looked into it. It's pretty simple, to be honest. It's not, it's just something that can happen.
CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard were both part of that group chat, and they appeared before Senate lawmakers yesterday for a previously scheduled hearing where they faced tough questions about how this security breach could have happened.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering this, and he's with us now with more. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
So Democrats really pushed Gabbard and Ratcliffe on this group chat revelation. Just remind us, what are the security concerns here?
Well, there are a couple of issues here. First off, this group chat reportedly involved sensitive strategy discussions among top U.S. officials, including the vice president. And it also reportedly involved discussions about targeting, about weapons and attack sequencing of U.S. military strikes in Yemen before those airstrikes happened. These discussions weren't on a secure U.S. government communication system. They instead were in a group chat set up by National Security Advisor Mike Waltz on the Signal messaging app, which is commercially available, widely used by all sorts of folks. Our colleague Tom Bowman is reporting that the Pentagon warned actually just last week against using Signal even for unclassified information. The Pentagon said Russian hackers are targeting the app to spy on people of interest. So That's issue number one. Issue number two here is that a journalist, the editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, was included in this group chat. And that, of course, is a serious security breach.
So what did the director of National Intelligence and the CIA director have to say about this yesterday when they appeared before lawmakers?
Well, initially, Tulsi Gabbard wouldn't even acknowledge that she was in the chat. For his part, though, CIA Director John Ratcliffe didn't try to play that game. He said straight out he was part of this chat. But he did say U.S. officials are permitted to use Signal to communicate and coordinate for government work purposes. He and Gabbard said there was no classified information shared in this chat. The White House has said the same thing. But that line received a lot of skepticism from lawmakers on the panel. And that includes Maine Independent Angus King.
If that's the case, please release that whole text stream so that the public can have a view of what actually transpired on this discussion. It's hard for me to believe that targets and timing and weapons would not have been classified.
Now, Ratcliffe and Gabbard both said at one point that the information from an intelligence perspective wasn't classified, but that when it comes to specific military information about the airstrikes, they said the Secretary of Defense has the authority to determine what's classified and what's not on that. So pointing to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth for answers on those questions, Hegseth was not at this hearing yesterday, but he has said publicly that nobody was texting war plans.
So what happens next with this?
Well, the same intelligence officials are testifying before House lawmakers today. They'll no doubt face more questions. But stepping back a bit, the top Democrat in the House and Senate are both calling for an investigation. Democrats, of course, don't have a lot of power. They're in the minority. Republicans control both houses of Congress. Some GOP senators have expressed concern about this security breach and how this all went down. That includes the Senate Majority Leader John Thune. He told reporters yesterday that they need to figure out what happened. So there may be more to come on this.
So let me just mention here that Catherine Marr, who's the CEO of NPR, chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation. And that is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
At the Supreme Court today is another challenge to the way federal agencies operate. The issue basically boils down to this. Did Congress overstep when it tasked the Federal Communications Commission with getting accessible and subsidized internet to remote and underserved areas? NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
At the center of the case is Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution, which has just 25 words. Quote, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives." It's called the Vesting Clause because it vests the country's lawmaking power in Congress. But it says nothing either way about when or if Congress can delegate its powers. Some conservatives have long argued that Congress may not delegate its power at all. Others say it's a question of degree. But in any event, today's case involving the FCC could make it much more difficult for Congress to establish programs and authorize agencies to carry out congressional objectives. More than 90 years ago, Congress created the FCC to ensure the availability of affordable and reliable communication services throughout the United States. Initially, the agency established a system of implicit subsidies by requiring telephone companies to charge below-cost rates in rural areas where it was harder and more expensive to build phone networks, while in cities where it was easier to build those networks, the agency allowed the phone companies to charge more. In other words, in order to create universal service available to all, city dwellers were subsidizing rural areas. By 1996, though, the world of telecommunications was bursting with innovations from the internet to broadband, and Congress overhauled the act, among other things, replacing the old system of implicit subsidies with explicit subsidies. Under the 1996 law, the FCC is charged with figuring out how much each telecommunications company must pay into the Universal Service Fund. And for all practical purposes, the charges are passed on to customers on their telephone or internet bills. The question before the Supreme Court is whether that system is an unconstitutional delegation of congressional power. Challenging the law is Consumers Research, an anti-regulatory conservative group that targets what it considers woke policies. It contends that the way the Universal Service Fund works amounts to a tax and that only Congress can enact taxes. So the system is unconstitutional. Representing the group in the Supreme Court is lawyer Trent McCotter.
The power here is the power to tax, which is a power that's very strictly legislative.
He contends that not only has Congress unconstitutionally given away its power over taxation, it's done so twice over because the FCC created a nonprofit private contractor to figure out how much each telecommunications company must pay into the Universal Service Fund. The agency counters that the Universal Service Fund fees are not a tax, and that whatever one chooses to call them, they were authorized by Congress in order to ensure coverage for rural areas. Indeed, providing universal service is the core mission of the FCC, says Republican Richard Wiley, who served as chairman of the agency during the Nixon administration.
Somebody's got to run the program. Congress can't run the program after they set it up.
That's what the FCC was established to do, he says, adding that Congress authorized the nonprofit that manages the fund payment system to be supervised by the commission.
This is really getting into the nitty-gritty of whether a E-rate company has submitted the proper charges for their services, whether people have applied these particular programs properly.
This is not a rubber stamp system, he says, noting that during his tenure and since then, the commission has overruled the findings of the nonprofit manager from time to time. Two federal appeals courts have sided with the FCC in this case, and one, the conservative Fifth Circuit, has ruled the other way, invalidating the FCC's Universal Service Fund as an unconstitutional delegation of congressional power. Now the Supreme Court, with a 6-3 conservative majority, will have the final say on whether to revive the long-dormant so-called non-delegation doctrine. If it strikes down the FCC program, the implications across the regulatory spectrum could be profound. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
So, college basketball fans, you already know March Madness is well underway, but do you know about March Napness?
That's right. Napness is where bears are unknowingly, because they're asleep, entered into a hibernation competition.
March Napness is a bracket-style tournament, which we do every year. The bear that remains sleeping the longest is crowned king or queen for that year.
Claire LaFrance is with the International Animal Welfare Organization, Four Paws.
As long as we've been doing this competition, it is a nail-biter. I mean, they will have you on the edge of your seat. It's really anybody's guess.
Four Paws houses more than 135 rescued brown bears in sanctuaries around the world, mainly in Europe.
These are European brown bears, and most of them are rescued from inappropriate or inadequate keeping conditions. So these bears are bears that cannot be returned to the wild.
LaFrance says their bears typically start hibernating in October or November, and they can sleep well into April. Out of the 23 bears competing this year, about a dozen are awake now.
They're on their own time. They wake up when they want.
They need to be awake for 5 consecutive days before they are disqualified.
When animals, especially bears, hibernate, they can actually wake up from time to time. You know, it's not like this comatose. They can wake up. They can get out of their den, they can walk around, maybe have a snack, and then go back to sleep.
And individual bears don't wake up at the same time every year.
We have this bear, Tyson. He was one of last year's finalists in March Napness. And in a shocking turn of events, he woke up in the earliest phases of the competition. And he's just snacking on apples and totally living his best life.
LaFrance says no one has ever predicted the outcome with a perfect bracket. Some swag is waiting as a prize if there's a first timer this year. But she says the real winners are the bears.
They could really help bring back the movement that sleep is self-care and there's no harm in taking a little nap when you need it.
Well, we know that. Layla, okay, Layla, between us, who do you think would win?
I mean, when you said March Napness, I was like, this is a competition I can get behind. this is my area.
Right, this is your superpower.
This is my superpower. Naps are delicious.
This is NPR News.
She's alone, lone, 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 diddy-o. without her. Get along without him. Long did he own. Every Saturday night she came in with him. Table six in the back, tall beer and a gin. Now she comes in alone. Long did he own. Safer than him, and he leaves and he makes you pay for your gin. Now she comes in alone. Long did he own. Top down, skip town, yellow Corvette. Up to the East Bay, tree sway, never get wet. Gonna head for the hills on Montana. Gotta get away from these mad Santa Ana. Lone did he own. In the back, tall beer and a gin. Now she comes in alone. Long did he own. And he lies, says he'll keep you safer. And he leaves and it makes you pay for. Now she comes in alone. Long did he own.
That was Lone Didion by Andrew Bird from his album Inside Problems. We had a request from Janet from Staples in honor of hearing about the New York Public Library archives of Joan Didion and John Donne. She asked if we could play Lone Didion by Andrew Bird, so we did.
Yeah, she said, awesome, thank you. what a fun thing. She's probably drinking her coffee. She suggested a song, and then suddenly she heard it. That's KEXE. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We heard earlier from Steve. We were talking about signs of spring or what you look forward to in springtime. That's our question of the week. He said, in regards to the skunk smell, in St. Paul, we like to play, is it skunk or is it weed?
Mm.
Also, for summer, I'm looking forward to my old man soccer league and riding bikes. So, there we go.
I also, this is my time of the year where I enjoy walks the most because it's not too hot yet. You can just put on like a sweatshirt.
Yeah.
And you're pretty comfy. You just roll up the sleeves when you get a little too warm or
yep.
something.
Yep.
Maybe you have a hat on. You can take that off and then spin it around on your hand like
Wow.
Like a
do you have a cane and a top like hat too? Oh yeah. like the spinning plates?
Yeah.
We'd love to hear from you this morning. That is our question of the week. What are you looking forward to? What is your favorite sign of spring? We heard from so many students yesterday. It was really fun, as always, on Phenology. And you can get access to those audio stories. They'll be available later this week at kaxc.org.
Is there any certain music you listen to during springtime to get you like, all right, it's officially spring?
No, but maybe I should. Maybe I should put together a spring playlist.
See, I feel like Vampire Weekend's a good band to listen to when it gets to be springtime, especially Contra for some reason. Okay. That album, their second album.
Okay. Why? What is it about?
Because it's like kind of, it's more like boppy music. And I feel like you need that during springtime.
Yeah.
Because you're like getting into the mood of like, all right, summer's just around the corner. Going to be able to be outside all the time.
Right.
Whatnot. You just need to get into that mindset. And I feel like Vampire Weekend's a good gateway band in summertime sadness. Just kidding. I just wanted to make a Lana Del Rey reference.
I'm excited. I always like it when it becomes deck time again, where I can go sit out on the deck. Now, right now we have the chairs still over on their side. So as soon as those get propped up and the cushions come back out, that'll be spring for me. It's not a nature thing, but then I can sit out there with the Merlin app and learn about birds. See, the birds are going crazy at my feeder from where I work from home.
The place I lived at before where I'm currently at had a porch, and I'll miss having a porch this springtime.
Yeah.
Just love sitting there, especially when it's raining. You can just sit there on the porch and enjoy the rain.
It's pretty good.
Woo!
I do like the sound of rain and thunderstorms. That's always really fun as you're falling asleep if it's not too severe. But
I do my crying in the rain.
Oh, do you? Oh, okay. Lisa's not in baseball, right? Coming up in the next hour, I'm excited. We're going to meet Gabby Findeay. Gabby is a local athlete, and she broke the all-time scoring record for Cass Lake Bena basketball, and she's headed to Bemidji State University for their basketball team next fall. We're going to find out more about Gabby coming up at 8:10.
And now it's time for From the Vault, where we play something from the KBXE vinyl library here at KBXE Studios as a way to encourage volunteers, especially our On the River volunteers, to play something from the vinyl library. There's so much music back there just waiting to be played. And today I've got a special tune. It is Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. I was surprised we had a Jonathan Richman record back there. And the song I'm going to play is Rockin' Shopping Center.
1, 2, I want to basement. Let's go. Well, I landed at a shopping center in an unknown state. Unknown kind of architecture, atmosphere and trait. Unknown brands and labels, unknown market chains, the strangest collection of buildings here upon a fruited place. And let's rock, let's go. All right, nice. You got the different labels and the different brands, each little region across the land, different colors in the different states, different labels. And let's tell them Barbados are all the different states for all the different traits. And as of this date, I hate no state. Let's rock, let's go. All right. I done got tired, so I done sat down. I watched the people for a while, you always learn a little. Diddly doody doik 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 diddle. Let's rock, let's go. Go, go, 8 bars. a giant sign says Momo Plaza. These setters, I don't know, it has a weirdo insignia. They put on all the bags, they wrote it on the walls, even made a flag. If I were shop etc., I'd sure be embarrassed. I know I'd never get a date with some cute little building like from Paris. Let's rock.
All right, that was Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers with Rockin' Shoppin' Center. got a text, my personal text, not from the text line, from volunteer host Darren, who volunteer hosts on the river.
Yeah.
Said thanks for the Jonathan Richman this morning.
JR, that's how much he was enjoying it. We heard from Noah. He says, Noah up near Britt here. Remind Andrew that Beck is great springtime music.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And Dave Murphy says, great song choice, Andrew. What a fun start to my day. And we've been talking about spring and your favorite part of the seasons changing. Liz from the Tamarack Amusement Park says, I am loving listening to our lake boom and crack in the changing spring temperatures. Correct. Every once in a while, I'll hear that and wonder, what is happening? Are there ghosts outside? It is very haunting and very cool. We'd love to hear from you. What are you looking forward to in spring? Have you already heard or seen something that keeps you going? You can text us at 218-326-1234. It's the Wednesday morning show. I'm Heidi Holton with Andrew DeZingo. We've got best wishes coming up. We'd like to thank Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids. They provide personalized care in a home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com.
And support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Blast Wi-Fi, featuring Wi-Fi 6 technology to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. Time now for best wishes. We do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday and happy anniversary for today, March 26th.
Kevin Bovee, not from Bovee, but from Duluth. Happy birthday to you.
And Chris Broomer, celebrating a birthday today. Happy birthday, Chris. And now we're going to play a song to help celebrate these birthdays. This is from the Bongo Hop Band from their album La Pata Coja. This song is the title track.
buscar, buscando sentido a la vida. Oye, esta vida es como una pata coja. Sin saber qué resolver, daba vueltas en un boomerang de noches. Cogiendo estoy, sigo sin entender, pero siempre hay una luz al final del camino. Me levanté, volví a creer, ya sé.
That was the Bongo Hop with the song La Pata Coja from their new album of the same name. If you have a birthday or anniversary to share, text us at 218-326-1234. And we heard from Tracy in Pequot Lakes. Happiest birthday to my favorite baby brother, Jerry DeChane, turns 53 today. Happy birthday, Jerry.
Yeah, he's in Brainerd. Hope it's a great day. That's a good age. Happy 53rd to you. We also heard from Carol in Apple Valley. Her favorite sign of spring is the return of the red-winged blackbirds. I was feeling a certain way about my first spring here in the metro after leaving the North Country. Lo and behold, in my commute, I saw a red-winged blackbird perched on a Highway 77 sign. Smiley face.
And we heard from Tammy Bobrowski. I like the Jonathan Richman song, which we played on the KBXE from the vault. And he and the Modern Lovers actually played at BSU back in the day, and they were panned by a local critic. Found this article in the university archives, and it is not a pleasant review of the Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, which I would, oh my gosh, I would absolutely have loved to have seen them live.
Yeah.
Jonathan Richman was in Fargo when I lived there and was doing a solo show, and I saw him load his stuff in a bus, or not a bus, a van.
Wow.
And I... For some reason, I don't know why I did this, but I started telling people that I had a cigarette with Jonathan Richman to sound cool. And I don't know why I did that. What a weird lie.
Have you had cigarettes with musicians?
Or almost with Father John Misty. He was smoking a cigarette while I was talking with him.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So in a way.
You didn't ask him for a puff, though.
No, I just talked to him about 3D glasses. That's my claim to fame, talking to Father John Misty when he was an opener at this same club.
Wow. We heard from Bill. He says, my sign of spring is coyotes yipping and howling in my yard and on the lake. It's been happening every night for the past 10 days or so between midnight and 2 a.m. And I forgot there was I got a text in from a friend last night, and then yesterday on the morning show, Tornado Bob talked about good Northern Lights weather.
Ooh.
And last night he's got a great photo up on his Facebook page. About it's like this purple, violet, and red slanting upward. Yeah, very, very cool. The change in the colors of the Northern Lights as well. So, and it's that interesting thing of like you can kind of see it with the naked eye, but it's the photographs that really bring out what's out there. So, did you see the Northern Lights last night? We'd love to hear from you. You can text 218-326-1234.
So, are frogs starting to sing their tunes?
Not
is that a
yet.
Sign of summer or is that a sign of spring?
Oh, I think spring. I love the peepers in the spring. Oh, I just love that now that you brought that up. Cannot wait for that. They'll start waking up soon, right? The frogs?
I think so.
They're so amazing.
Though we might get snow this weekend, so who knows?
Yeah. We're talking spring, we think, and we keep having these kind of weekends, don't we, that possibly a blizzard, possibly snow. We'll see what happens.
But as for weather, this right now, partly cloudy today with highs 46 to 50 degrees, mostly cloudy in the evening, lows 25 to 30. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs 46 to 53, north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tomorrow night, overnight lows in the upper 20s, lower 30s. Then Friday, not quite snow, but rain likely happening, mostly cloudy, highs 42 to 50 degrees. Now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition. We're going to hear about Lollapalooza.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. In the early 1990s, American rock music was just beginning to emerge from the hair metal era. And one of the most influential bands to lead the transition was Jane's Addiction.
Here we go!
Just as Jane's Addiction was starting to gain traction, though, the constantly feuding band announced their final tour in 1991. Frontman Perry Farrell invited some of his favorite bands to hit the road with them, and he called the traveling music show Lollapalooza, and it was chaos right from the start.
They come out on stage the first night, and the two principal members, Perry Farrell and Dave Navarro, start brawling on stage.
That's Richard Beanstock. He's one of the editors of a new oral history of Lollapalooza. Tom Bojour is the co-editor. He added that the band Nine Inch Nails also had a rough first show.
You're going to get what you deserve.
The entire Nine Inch Nails musical system is plugged into this one electrical drop box, and it just shorts out. And Trent Reznor freaks out, smashes his equipment. Everybody else smashes their equipment.
Instead of folding on day one, Lollapalooza went on to define what rock would become in the 1990s. Richard Beanstock and Tom Bojour interviewed hundreds of people responsible for making that traveling circus possible, including its founder, Perry Farrell.
His vision was really to represent a diverse set of bands, which he did. He had Ice-T, Susie and the Banshees, but also a diverse set of ideas. So that's why he developed the idea of having all of these booths and tents around where he would hopefully, as he said, have the NRA next to Greenpeace and really showcase opposing ideas. You know, that he was really idealistic and maybe unrealistic, but that was his brief. He really wanted to make something where different ideas came into contact with each other.
It was exciting, chaotic, a lot of fights, a lot of drugs. What's your favorite story that you heard from the people you interviewed?
There is like a lot of very, very weird stuff. I think the strangest thing that happened was in 1994 when the band L7, who were an all-female punk rock band, teamed up with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and they were so bored that they decided to create papier-mâché cars and wigs and reenacted the Kennedy assassination on stage, and not only on stage, but in Dallas, and it went over very badly. That really sort of shows off the kind of bad judgment and cabin fever that can occur when you spend 8 weeks on a bus.
Richard, you were there, right? You were there for the first 3 years. So, I mean, it lasted for actually maybe longer than anyone would have thought, considering how it started. How did Lollapalooza eventually find its footing?
I think that even with all the technical type difficulties that we're talking about on the first night, Perry had a great vision. Some of the other organizers, like, these were people that were pros and were pretty keyed into the scene. Some of it is also just being right place, right time. Lollapalooza 1991 happens less than a month after it finishes. Nirvana's Nevermind comes out. So by the summer of 1992, alternative music is fully mainstream, and Lollapalooza is fully in the center of that.
And Richard, one of the unique things, though, about Lollapalooza is that it really tried to cross boundaries and mix genres. Ice-T on the first tour, along with his heavy metal band Body Count, then Ice Cube, Coolio, Snoop, they all played Lollapalooza. What was the idea behind bringing all of these genres together in one place?
It really was a unique thing at the time, and now it's something that we just kind of take for granted. I mean, if you look at any of these festivals, Coachella, Bonnaroo, it's hip-hop and pop and rock and all these things right next to each other. But that was not happening in 1991. And again, that was one of the main conceits of Lollapalooza, that you could do something like this. So the fact that they were doing it, like, should not be underestimated. It really was a unique thing at the time.
Yeah, and the thing is, too, like with Perry Farrell, as much as he was the genius and inspiration behind Lollapalooza, if he had gotten his way on certain decisions when it comes to lineup, there might not have been Pearl Jam at Lollapalooza in 1992. There might not have been Green Day at Lollapalooza. I mean, how many creative clashes were there when it came to figuring out who exactly would be at Lollapalooza, Tom?
I think that there was a lot of behind the scenes friction, and the founders say to us, you know, we were music snobs. So they really did not book a lot of the sort of more popular alternative rock bands of the era. So there was a constant push and pull between what was cool, what was commercial enough. And of course, this sort of ends up with the festival booking Metallica as a headliner in 1996, which is pretty much considered the moment when Lollapalooza jumps the shark. Perry Farrell is so incensed by Metallica being made the headliner that he actually steps down from the festival altogether. And while it does draw more people, it really doesn't do that well because of the increased cost, and it never really recovers the gleam of being this alternative bastion and sort of North Star.
Richard, considering that you were there as a teenager watching the first few shows, is this book a bit of a love letter to Lollapalooza as opposed to the uncensored story of Lollapalooza?
I think in some ways it probably is. I think even if you love something, if you just show that side of it, then you're not really showing much anyway. So within all of the gritty details, I think that the real personality of it comes out, and hopefully that's what we captured.
It's also a little bit wistful because, according to all of the people involved with the festival, given the economics of touring now, a festival like this that would tour around the country with this many artists of that stature is actually impossible to do. So it's really an artifact of a bygone time. It's not going to happen again. So it's a celebration of something that can't be reproduced.
Richard Beanstock and Tom Bozier co-wrote Lollapalooza, the uncensored story of alternative rock's wildest festival. Richard, Tom, thanks for taking us back.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Lollapalooza does still exist, but now it's just a four-day affair in Chicago's Grant Park with a few international spin-offs. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heidi Holton. We receive support from the Northwest Minnesota Foundation, serving two tribal nations in 12 counties in Northwest Minnesota, supporting ideas and providing resources to lift up the people, businesses, and communities who call Northwest Minnesota home. More at nwmf.org.
We'd also like to thank Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, and saunas. Learn more online at hotspringhottubmn.com.
So, Heidi, you were telling me that you have been to the first Lollapalooza.
I did. It was 1991 at Harriet Island in St. Paul, and I was there.
You were there.
Yes.
Much like James Murphy from LCD Sound System, you were there.
Exactly.
That is exactly a great reference. And if you get that, please text us at 218-326-1234. We need to be friends.
I do remember seeing, I think it was Nine Inch Nails. Yeah, I saw Jane's Addiction. I didn't see the entire end. We're having someone pick us up in the traffic.
Did you get to hear Ben Cott Stealing? Jane says?
Jane says, for sure.
Okay.
I think we were walking out when Jane says, because it was just over everything. I remember the Rollins Band, Ice-T and Body Count and Living Color, Susie and the Banshees. Yeah, it was pretty fun. It was cool. We didn't really understand what the heck we were going to, but it seemed fun. And looking online, the ticket price was $25.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
You couldn't even get a ticket at 7th Street Entry for $25 now.
Yeah. Wow. Yep. So they are looking back. That was our story from National Public Radio at Lollapalooza. We'd love to hear from you this morning, 218-326-1234. Maybe it's about spring. I was just looking up spring peepers and when they might be waking up, and that's when the temperatures start to get a little bit warmer and they'll start croaking out there. I just love it. Love the sound of that.
And we were also talking about Northern Lights, and we heard from Linda, who sent us a picture from 10 p.m. last night, and it's a beautiful-looking picture of the Northern Lights from last night. Did you get to see them last night? Text us at 218-326-1234, and if you got pictures, send them our way. We'd love to see them.
We are working on a new series at KAXE.org. It is called Unplugged. We're kind of laying out how everything works here at KAXE, the past, the present, the future. We've got a great article from Sarah Bignall about how where we started and where we are right now and how we are funded with a nice pie chart. You know, so you can see like how much funding comes in for different things. And it really is between business supporters and our members. That's our largest single source of funding. And I have an article that just came out about how we choose and how we create programming for KEXE, whether it's the morning show or other programming. You can kind of catch it now. And there's some photos from over the years. I've been involved here for a long time, different projects and things that we've done over the years. You can catch it at KEXE.org.
And coming up in a bit, we're going to be talking to Gabby Findeay, who just broke the school record for most points scored for the Castlake Bina High School basketball team.
Yeah, I'm excited. One of the cool things about it, so she broke both her coach's record.
Wow.
How fun would that be? And then another player, and she went. Everyone expected it, and I watched some videos of Gabby playing last night. Holy cow, is she good. And she signed with Bemidji State University. She'll be playing for that team. So we'll get to meet Gabby coming up at 8:10. If you have a question you'd like us to ask her, send it our way. Text 218-326-1234.
And in about less than an hour, we're going to have Area Voices, my conversation with Patrick Strait, who wrote a book all about Acme Comedy Company. And it's a really fun conversation, so you'll want to tune in for that around 8:44, let's say. It's a bit of a longer interview because there's so much to talk about.
Yeah. We heard from Amy Heilman. She texted in. She sent two photos, beautiful photos, Amy, of the auroras over Lost Moose Lake last night at 10 p.m. Wow, that's an amazing photo with the stars out, too.
Yeah.
Looks like it was, wow, look at that one. Sorry, we just keep saying wow. But if you were there, if you saw it last night, you know how cool these Northern Lights are and that we get to see that kind of thing. Do you have a... So in an hour, we're learning about the comedy scene in Minnesota with this new book about Acme. You go to concerts all the time. Do you ever go see comedians?
Every once in a while. I went last year. Gosh, maybe that was last spring already. Maybe a year ago.
Okay.
Was the last time but they also have comedy here in Bemidji every once in a while.
Okay.
About once every other month.
Okay.
And so I get to regularly see comedy.
I think I went to Acme when I was going to school at the University of Minnesota. I went once, and there weren't that many people there. I felt very pressured to laugh at every joke. It was very uncomfortable for me. You know,
I'm very stern with my laughing.
Yeah,
I don't like it. I'm not going to laugh.
It's too people-pleasing back then, you know. But, I saw some of the... I like some of the comedy specials that are on, you know, some of the streaming services, and they make me kind of happy, but not a lot of them, not all of them.
Do you have a favorite comedian?
I I love Nate Bargatze.
Mm.
He makes me laugh. I think a lot, you know, I've watched those videos quite a bit and it's like they pop into my head and I've rewatched them with friends and we laugh a lot. I love Tig Notaro. Totally love her. I would go see her in a second. And though David Sedaris is not a comedian, he is a writer. That's a life goal for me to get to see David Sedaris live.
He comes to Fargo regularly.
Yeah, why don't
you
it.
Just need to make the trip.
I gotta do it. Yeah. Do you have a favorite comedian? You can text 218-326-1234. For a while, I think I've told you this before, so my parents lived in Las Vegas for about 20 years, so that became a weird, and Minnesota, became a weird kind of home away from home mm-hmm. for me. So I got to see the Smothers Brothers.
Wow.
Does that count as, that counts as comedy, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
Pretty amazing. It was old school, you know, where they're bringing back the original kind of Las Vegas stuff, so that was a lot of fun. But yeah, we'd love to hear from you. 218-326-1234.
So Japanese Breakfast released a new album last Friday called For Melancholy Brunettes and Sad Women. And I'm going to play a song for it. This is called Mega Circuit.
Melancholy Brunettes.
And that was Japanese Breakfast with their from their new album. That song was called Mega Circuit. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm here with Heidi Holton, and I'm Andrew Dzingel. I should introduce myself, too, while I'm at it.
That's right.
And we're here for one more hour, and then we're going to hand things over to Jennifer Barr for Headwaters.
I'm excited about that. She's going to bring us a great Headwaters show today. Hope you're having a good Wednesday.